supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The recent raid of a Texas polygamous sect brought the discussion of one of the oldest taboos to the fore, incest. Media's been discussing it off and on for many weeks ever since. But what does it mean exactly? What does it mean legally? What does it mean psychologically? On today's show, we're going to take a look at incest, its impact, and what new treatments are available. Our guest is Dr. Christine Courtois. She's been studying the effects of trauma for over 30 years. She's a co-founder and former clinical director of the Center at the Psychiatric Institute of Washington. She's also the author of Healing the Incest Wound, Adult Survivors in Therapy, and Recollections of Sexual Abuse. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
We'll also be joined later by two survivors of incest to discuss what impact it's had on them. We'll also hear from various other people, a lawyer telling us the legal implications, and we'll hear later in the show from someone who works with perpetrators. So if you, a loved one, or a survivor of incest or affected by it, give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Christine, I'm sure we'd agree it is one of the oldest taboos. I wonder, then, what makes this so forbidden, and if it is, why is it still relatively common? I mean, the numbers I hear range from 10 to 25%.
Mm-hmm. That's very common. It's very taboo, first of all, because of the genetic implications, but I think more than that today, it's because of the chaos and conflict that it has potential to put a family into, because there become many cross relationships, of course, and many rivalries and many, betrayals, and it does not make for a comfortable living arrangement for the most part.
So why is it so common?
Well, there's a lot of questions about that, and I don't think there's a clear answer. If you listen to feminists, the belief is that the patriarchal system has certainly allowed incest and passed it down through generations. And we also have found that some of the dynamics of incest and how it occurs in families and how the families function create almost an intergenerational capacity or an intergenerational dynamic that is seen as relatively normal in some families.
How so?
Those two things said, I think there are a lot of individual reasons for incest to occur also.
Like what?
Well, a perpetrator may be highly, highly stressed by life circumstances and might not turn towards, say, a child for sexual gratification under normal circumstances, but under stress might do so. Also, in sibling incest, and that's not always benign, by the way, but sibling incest sometimes occurs because there's a great deal of parental neglect that's going on, or because often an older brother is out of control, and he may model his behavior on other behavior that he sees in the family and then start to abuse his sisters.
Your throwaway comment just now when you said about sibling sexual activity. You said it's not always benign, by the way. I just heard many parents out in the audience wanting to know, when is it benign and when is it not?
Okay. Well, it's benign when it really meets the criteria for innocent exploration between siblings, and that's normal sexual behavior within the realm of normal sexual development. But when one child is being a predator of another child, and is considerably older or considerably larger or has more esteem in the family, and this is where, again, some of the feminist viewpoints come in. Often a male child is more valued or has more prerogative in a family, and the females do not. In those kind of circumstances, an older brother may take advantage of a younger sister, and that kind of contact often goes on quite frequently. And it's the duration and also the escalation and the fact that the victim doesn't feel free to talk to the parents because it's who is perpetrating. There are all kinds of split loyalties. All of those things make it very problematic.
Well, as long as we're talking about what is and is not incest, I want to broaden this a bit. I see many relationships between parents and children that go beyond affection and become sexualized. There's also questions about where blood stops and where it starts. So our producer, Elisa Walter, spoke with Danny Savalos. He's a criminal and civil attorney with law offices here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a piece of this interview and what he had to say about the definition of incest.
The legal definition of incest varies from state to state, but essentially it is the crime of sexual relations or marriage taking place between a male and a female who are so closely linked by blood or affinity that that activity is prohibited by law. For example, blood is somebody who is your direct descendant or your direct ancestor, and your ancestor would be your parents, and your descendant would be your children. They also include blood uncles, aunts, nieces, and nephews in most incest statutes.
Does that include in any way step-siblings, anything that's not blood-related?
That's a great question because I think the most compelling example is adoption. Adoption involves the creation of a relationship between someone who is not blood-related at all, but certainly most incest statutes will cover adoption. Similarly, the step and half question when it comes to siblings, half siblings are counted as full-blood siblings when it comes to incest. Step siblings, that definition may vary from state to state, but certainly after a divorce or a cessation of the familial relationship, there actually is no prohibition against, say, marrying your stepsister.
So that was attorney Danny Savalos, who practices in Philadelphia, defining what the law says about incest. How, as a psychologist, mental health professional, how would you define it?
Well, I define it in very much the same way, and I think it's very important to know what the law is in the individual state. However, as a psychologist, I am looking at it more broadly in terms of not necessarily meeting the legal definition, but meeting a more psychological definition, and that some contacts which might not rise to the legal definition certainly can still be damaging and could be considered incestuous. For example, showing a child pornography and using it for self-stimulation at the same time, although there may not be any physical contact with the child per se, and thus it doesn't meet the criminal statute, it still is incestuous and still has incestuous connotations emotionally and psychologically.
Christine, he talked about different types of incest, biological parent, step-parent, so on and so forth. Do these types of abuse have different impact? Is a child more or less likely to be injured if it's a step-parent?
Well, it's quite complicated. It depends on the circumstance itself, and every circumstance can vary, as you're suggesting. The specifics of the circumstance can vary. For example, it could be a step-parent and be a one-time occurrence that would have one set of repercussions, or it could be a step-parent and be quite, quite a common occurrence, and that would, I think, lead to different outcomes. So it really depends on how it's perpetrated, how often. On average, the younger the age of the child and the older the age of the perpetrator and the closer the degree of relatedness, all of those seem to relate to more severe outcomes.
What about violence?
Yes, that would also. And yet that's not the most commonplace situation. Most incest is perpetrated without violence, but maybe perpetrated with the threat of violence or the use of some, usually it's like what we see with other kinds of pedophile activities, with the threat of or coercion of the child
and
in some way.
Yeah, I would think that if a child is, quote, talked into it or manipulated into it,
right,
that child could carry a sense of self-blame or false responsibility.
Oh, absolutely. And the shame is just incredible. And if a perpetrator is effective, and most of them are in this way, they know how to manipulate and trick a child and make a child feel like it's his or her fault. And whether, even if the contact feels good to the child is still going to come away feeling ashamed.
Well, that brings me to the other issue. You said, if it feels good to the child.
Mm-hmm.
These children certainly are not able to deal with all of the emotions of being sexually molested. So what happens to the emotions, and where do they go? And I would also imagine complicating things is the being molested may on some occasions feel good physically, but also emotionally. I mean, they might love that person in addition to fearing them, or certainly they're dependent on them. That's a
absolutely
real complicated,
and that's part of what makes, in my view, makes incest so damaging and such a complicated traumatic stressor, because there are mixed levels of relationship to the person, and usually the perpetrator is not solely hated, but the different feelings that are set off, and including the sexual responses and sexual feelings, the perpetrator will usually use those in some way against the child to let the child know that it's the child's fault for having enticed the perpetrator, or that the child really wanted it, or it's the child's role to take care of the perpetrator, however it is.
Perpetrator aside, I mean, all of these emotions, how do they get managed inside a child's small psyche?
Well,
where do they go? What happens?
Well, if it's a short-term situation, usually a child will have those feelings and be open about them. But once it becomes a more repetitive and chronic and escalating circumstance, then what we find is many children separate from themselves and separate from their feelings and their bodies, and they will say things like, I started watching myself on the bed, or I watched him do it to me or her do it to me, and I wasn't there anymore. And children have a higher capacity than adults to dissociate, and over time they will dissociate to segregate the experience and segregate their emotions.
And
but the emotions are still there.
And in a way, that's quite adaptive.
In a way, that's quite adaptive, and I think it's life-saving.
Right.
However, what happens long-term is once dissociation starts to give way in some way, and that happens differently for different people, then they may have the traumatic responses, and all of those set-aside emotions come back in an unplanned way and a difficult way.
Well, we've got two people who are joining us, Christina, a man and a woman, both of whom are survivors of incest.
Mm-hmm.
Let's chat briefly first with Jeffrey. Jeffrey, your father was the perpetrator, yes?
Yes.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for doing this. It's pretty courageous, or it sounds pretty courageous to do this. I appreciate it. Tell us briefly what happened.
My father was, I have two older brothers and a younger sister. And for each of us, it started long before you can remember. And it was just an ongoing thing for some years until eventually word got outside the family.
You know what, Jeffrey? Are you there?
Yes.
Are you on a cell phone or a portable? Because we've got a bad connection.
No, was I talking too low, maybe?
Yeah, you were cutting out on us.
Well, so just say that over again. I have two older brothers and a younger sister. And for each of us, it started when probably toddlers, or I would think, I don't really know. And continued on for some years until word got out of the family, and he had to leave.
And this was done by your father. And tell us about your life. What impact did that have on you as a child? What was it like being Jeffrey as a small child?
Well, you just feel different and alone and isolated. You feel like you're different than everybody else, and in my case, since he had to leave, you feel like you're the boy from the broken home, and you are, in fact, the one who broke it.
So you felt guilty on top of that.
As Dr. Courtois was saying, it's just things that you really have no capacity to work your way through. I've explained to friends of mine that, you look at Sex and the City, it's a big movie and TV show and deals with mature adult women trying to figure out the complexities of a sexual relationship. And when you're seven and it's a parent or both parents, the complexities are just... Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just no chance to really try to work through them.
Well, Jeffrey, we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we want to talk to you more and our other guest a bit about the impact it's had on you over the short term and certainly over the long term. And perhaps the two of you and Leona, we can talk about treatments and what's available, what helps. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You were just listening to Jeffrey, who is an incest survivor. We will hear from another woman who's also a survivor after our break. We're joined, our guest today is Dr. Christine Courtois. She is a psychologist and co-founder of the Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorders at the Psychiatric Institute of Washington. She's also the author of Healing the Incest Wound, Adult Survivors in Therapy, and many other books. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Special Ops in Iran, we talk with investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. His article for The New Yorker magazine details U.S. clandestine military operations against Iran. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about incest, something that occurs to up to as many as 25% of all children. My guest is Dr. Christine Courtois. She is co-founder of the Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorders at the Psychiatric Institute of Washington. She's written many books, including Recollections of Sexual Abuse and Healing the Incest Wound. Before our break, we were talking to Jeffrey, who was abused by his father for the first several years of his life. And in a couple of minutes, we're going to be speaking with Leona, who's a female survivor of sexual abuse. Jeffrey, do we have you?
Yes.
Tell us about the impact of the abuse over the long haul. When did you realize what had happened to you?
Realize what happened or realize the effects of what happened?
Realize the effects.
Way too late. I was in my 40s before I really admitted what I just took to be quirks and idiosyncrasies and understood them as a problem.
Like, what do you mean by quirks and idiosyncrasies?
Being able to trust people, self-esteem kinds of things that really I was in. By the time I went into therapy, I was in therapy for a while before I really admitted or understood that. Anger, impatience, mood swings, that kind of thing. And I just took those as personality kinds of things that, with effort, I could just improve on.
So it's not as though you didn't remember the abuse.
No, unfortunately, I always remembered it.
Yeah, you just didn't link up your behavior with what was happening. Sounds like the missing link was all of those emotions that were probably still too big for you to feel.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, so, Christine, let me ask you, is the treatment then to help somebody like Jeffrey feel what he feels, feel what's living inside his body?
Yes, and also to make that connection. And what becomes difficult, and what Jeffrey's saying is really classic response pattern, is that we see that adults go into adulthood and, you know, may have difficulties, but they attribute them to themselves. And at some point, they usually get more serious and require them to go to therapy or seek some help. And it's not until a connection is made that they can begin to understand. And I always talk to my own patients about the context of what happened to them when they were younger, and taking it away from them and really trying to understand it in the context of something very traumatic happened to them, and sorting out a lot of the reactions as post-traumatic responses that have occurred in delayed form, or they may have been there all along, but they were not identified as such. And this brings us back to the topic of dissociation, because it's usually in adulthood that the dissociation begins to either show itself, or when it breaks down, then the emotions and the story and the traumatic reactions begin to emerge.
So we can go a lifetime or parts of a lifetime still not having the capacity to feel what we feel.
Correct. And even with all the discussion of child sexual abuse, I believe that there's still not enough context to understand for, especially for adult survivors. And the word incest isn't used these days very often. It's still shrouded in secrecy. It's still shrouded in taboo. So if you've had that experience, it's very hard to gain an understanding of what it might have done to you.
Well, it's interesting, Christine. You know, people always ask me, well, what's your show about today? What's your show about mm-hmm. this week? And I'll just say that word, uh-huh. incest. And the reaction is 100% consistent. I get a wince or an ugh or something mm-hmm. like that. But mm-hmm. the message is I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know about that.
Right.
It's revulsion. So that adds to the shame. Let's get to meet Leona. Leona, do we have you there? Leona?
Yes.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to be a part.
The background I got was that you were incested from infancy to puberty.
Yes.
Did you realize what was happening?
When my parents were divorced when I was about 4, and that was when since then, it's been known that my father molested children. He was found molesting a child when I was 4 years old. And so it's sort of always been known that that's his behavior.
And he continued that with you until puberty?
Yes.
Why did it stop in puberty?
I believe that's a common thing with a true pedophile who had sexual interest in a child. Once I had breasts and began menstruating, his interest was no longer.
So can you tell us what your life was like in your early childhood up to adulthood?
While the incest was happening?
And after.
And after?
Yeah.
The in my experience, the unusual piece of it being known that there was supervised, that at the time of my parents' divorce, which would have been in the early 70s, there was supervised visitation. There were very strict rules around that, and my father was ordered to seek counseling, and, you know, things were tended to. As time went on, he got sicker and stronger. My mother got sicker and weaker, and everything just fell away. Supervised visitation stopped, which allowed the incest to increase and continue until I reached puberty, when he was no longer interested. And then he was, you know, abusive in other ways, but the specific sexual abuse discontinued. And the specific abuse for me was oral rape, with him inserting his penis in my mouth, rubbing his penis on my face, fondling my vagina while putting on my seatbelt, pulling my bathing suit to the side when I swam, and fondling and digitally penetrating my vagina.
Tell me how you are now, and tell us how you are now.
Now I am stronger than I've ever been, and the most essential ingredient in my healing has been community. But the deadliest thing I've survived is isolation. That incest is horrible, and we were, you know, there was poverty, there was violence, there were all kinds of issues. But the reason that it was deadly was that we were isolated, that I was isolated, that there was no community. And now I have community. I have support systems of varying degrees. I have, you know, professional assistance with a doctor and a therapist, and a meeting of equals, with meeting with other survivors, talking with people who have been where I've been, who've experienced what I've experienced, and are healing and living a rich and full life.
Tell me about the quality of your life now.
The quality of my life now, I believe, is sort of better than average. I have a lot of love in my life. I have dear friends who are supportive of me, and I enjoy taking opportunities like this. And I've spoken at my state capitol recently, and spoken to doctors and students and so forth about the effects of trauma and recovering from that. And I go to the theater and the beach and ride the carousel. So I feel like I really have a rich and full life, and it's I'm at a place where I'm really doing very well.
Are you in an intimate relationship? Are you okay with them, or is that difficult for you?
Romantic relationships continue to be a challenge. Most recently, I was in a romantic relationship with someone who I've been friends with for a number of years. He has addiction issues sparked by his own trauma and abuse, and he's not able to live in a stable way, so we're not able to be together because of that. So that continues to be a challenge, because trust of myself and of others continues to be an issue, but it certainly progresses.
What is it that you think our listeners really need to know, or you would like to say before we say goodbye to you?
That secrets and isolation are really deadly, that I have seen the destruction that they bring, that there needs to be people in my life who know what's happened to me, that it's not my shame that I feel. The shame is not mine. The shame belongs to the perpetrator.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting how that is pretty typical of what happens. We're going to talk to Christine more about that, that the person who should feel the shame whenever there's child abuse usually doesn't feel it, and one who shouldn't mm-hmm. feel the shame does. Leon, I want to thank you so much, and I do wish you the best. I wish you continued happiness with your life.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
So, Christine, she brings up an interesting dimension here. She focuses on the issue of the secret and shame and how community itself is healing.
Right. There are many dimensions that she's mentioning that are traumatic, and one of the big ones is to be isolated and to be abandoned and not to be helped. And even, you know, her case sounds like even with appropriate intervention, it fell away, even when the system knew that this man was a molester. And that's unfortunately not uncommon either. And those kinds of situations will make a child believe even more, it must be my fault, or I must have done something to deserve this, and reinforce all of that shame over time.
Well, we know that Leona really found healing in community. Let's see if we can bring Jeffrey mm-hmm. back on. Jeffrey?
Yes.
We have you. You're still there. Good. Tell us how you are now and what has your treatment therapy process been like for you?
Well, things are better in many ways now. It's comforting to have finally made the connections between what happened and how it affected me. And I'd never made that connection. The kinds of connections that Leona spoke about is real important to me, being able to connect with other kind, with other incest victims in a informal fellowship, really, that assists each other. Therapy's been very important. Much of what, and maybe because I waited so long before I really admitted any of it, but you know, therapy has shown me how to make those kinds of connections. It didn't help my marriage, which ended in the middle of all this, and but my relationships with my children have been good. Friendships that I had for many years turned out to be much more powerful and beautiful than I would have ever guessed beforehand in how supportive they've been. So it's like starting over, you know. I mean, I'm still only, you know, just barely getting started with recovery. But optimistic, you know. I think whatever comes for me from here forward is going to be good. You know, the support that I found through Survivors of Incest Anonymous, that's the organization that I belong to, and through some friends, my sister and I have, having always been close and always good friends, that's even deepened some since we've, since it all came to a head. So, you know, I mean, I'm optimistic. You know, it's still a day-by-day kind of thing, but I'm optimistic and almost excited.
There's I've quoted this often, Jeffrey, in the Diaspora Museum in Israel. There's a cornerstone that, to me, is the best definition of mental health I ever heard. It said, to remember the past, to live in the present, and to trust the future. And that sounds exactly where you are right now in your life, and I do wish you the best. I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Christine, tell us about therapy and what it looks like and how it's changed over 30 years.
Well, it's changed considerably in 30 years because originally, and certainly to today, there is a necessity to identify the incest and to explore the feelings associated with it, as you were suggesting. But one of the things that's been found quite significantly is often incest occurs in a family where there is a great deal of other dysfunction, and that many of the children coming out of these families have not had basic attachment security in their lives, nor have they had the basics of how to regulate their emotions. And in the context of being injured and traumatized, they learn to self-soothe in a variety of ways that are often maladaptive for them when they, as they grow older, for example, through self-mutilation or through chronic suicidality or through drugs or eating disorders or whatever. And I did want to mention, Dan, that we it's often neglected that many of these families have addiction problems in them to begin with.
Right.
So there's that underlay that occurs in a family also that shouldn't be neglected. And so the treatment is now seen as something that's sequenced and progressive, and that it's built on initially helping individuals to get their lives stabilized and to identify the connections and to develop safety in their lives and to develop the therapeutic relationship. And I think, as both survivors indicated, trust and mistrust in particular are really big issues, and they enter the therapy relationship.
So
the therapist has to be prepared for that and has to be absolutely trustworthy and, you know, understand that there will be challenges to trustworthiness that are part of the therapeutic process. So I like to say that the process and the relationship itself are part of what's healing.
Because
you have an adult authority figure who is not exploitive and who is, in fact, encouraging you to have your own feelings and to be you and to not, you know, be dissociated from your feelings.
Well, you talked about, you know, therapist has to be prepared, patient does too, that we're not going to get a quick change here.
No, it takes time.
The process does take time, and everyone has to be patient.
Right.
We're going to have to take a short break here, and when we come back, we're going to hear again from Danny Savalos about the legal implications of incest for perpetrators. We're also going to hear from Dr. Barry Zachary. He's with the Joseph J. Peters Institute here in Philadelphia, and they provide assessment and treatment to perpetrators. We've been listening to the issues surrounding incest with Dr. Christine Courtois. She's been in the field for over 30 years, published many books, including Healing the Incest Wound, Adult Survivors in Therapy. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
When you're alone, hey, Chad here. On the next Radio Lab, we look at what happens when a song gets stuck in your head.
Not a bad melody, huh?
Like really stuck.
Playing incessantly.
Over and over and over.
Over and over again.
And it won't go away.
Nothing he could do could make it stop.
And you're like, oh God, please leave me be.
I thought I'd never sleep again.
The Mystery of Earworms. That's the next Radio Lab.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Let's go surfing now.
In the 1960s, it seemed all of America was California dreaming.
Everywhere you looked, there was this sense of exuberant well-being about being a Californian.
But the country was headed for a rude awakening.
You've got to make it stop!
Blocks were decimated by fire and looters.
A time when the Golden State lost its glitter.
It really was kind of waking up from a dream.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about incest and its impact today. But now let's take a look at the perpetrators. We'll go back to the interview our producer Elisa Walters did with Danny Savalos. He's a criminal attorney here in Philadelphia. She asked him about the legal consequences of incest.
In almost every state, it's a felony, and it's a very serious crime. Furthermore, with a lot of the federal statutes now that we've heard of, most of these offenders would have to register, and that can be a lifetime of additional sort of punishment, depending on how you view it. Certainly the registration is for the safety of the community, but these sex crimes carry with them some very serious penalties now. And as I said, in almost all states, they're a felony.
So tell me how the law treats forced incest compared to consensual incest.
In many cases of incest, two crimes have been committed, both rape and also incest. So figuring out how long someone's going to be in jail is a function of which of those crimes they've been charged with, or both. If it's forced, then you certainly have a rape situation, because rape is the act of sexual intercourse without consent. It's essentially a battery. In the case of incest, the crime of incest does not care whether or not someone was a consensual partner, unwilling, willing. The crime is defined by knowingly having sexual relations with somebody who is within a certain degree of consanguinity or affinity or blood relationship.
Do we know how many cases make it to court?
Well, I think the converse of that question is how many cases don't make it to court, and is certainly, unfortunately, the case with familial sexual abuse. Many cases never make it to court because they go unreported for obvious reasons that children are afraid, children are embarrassed, family members are afraid of retaliation. So certainly we can measure the number of cases that do make it to court, but I think many experts would agree that that is not an accurate representation of how many acts of both incest and familial rape occur in this country.
How has the law evolved? Because you hear about places like France and Sweden where you are allowed to marry your brother or sister. It's not punishable. But in America, there are many states like Texas and Ohio that are trying to get laws passed to legalize incest.
There is a lot of question about incest, which is recognized almost universally as a societal taboo. And by taboo, I mean that it's something that everyone agrees is wrong. And those are very rare occurrences in our society. We don't have many things that are universally wrong. Killing is not even universally wrong. Indeed, if you're a soldier in war, or if you've been convicted of the worst of crimes, our society condones and actually partakes in killing. So for some reason, incest has become a taboo. And when you really examine the origins of it, it really is, it's an interesting inquiry, because indeed, we just know it's wrong, but is that a God-given concept? Is it something that's biologically inherent that we know is just wrong? Certainly, studies have revealed that it's genetically and biologically unhealthy for offspring of incestuous relationships, but it's an interesting question to look at incest historically and say, where did this come from? Where did this taboo, this global repugnancy towards this crime, where did it originate?
Indeed, where did it originate? That was Danny Savalas. He's a criminal and civil attorney here in Philadelphia, and she spoke with producer Alisa Walters. Now we're going to speak with Dr. Barry Zachary. He's a psychologist and director of the Adult Outpatient Program at the Joseph J. Peters Institute here in Philadelphia. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yourself?
No, not too bad, thanks.
Many male perpetrators have been victims of incest themselves. Tell us about the transition from victim to perpetrator without having experienced survivor in the middle.
Well, we know that situations that basically lead to child sexual abuse can get repeated intergenerationally or cross-generationally. And however, it's not a precondition, actually, or it's In many cases, actually, that we see, in most cases that we see, child sexual abuse does not necessarily lead to sexual offending in the future, nor is the fact that, there is also the fact that many offenders that begin offending, let's say, in their adulthood, particularly in their 30s and onward, and these are fathers, for example, molesting their own children, they've never been sexually abused per se. I do have to say, though, that I think there's certainly some sort of a link that has been evident in terms of sexual abuse leading in certain vulnerable individuals to acting out sexually in the future. However, we kind of underestimate the other source of abuse that can lead to what Christine referred to as basically insecure attachments and problems in interpersonal relationships. So things such as physical and emotional abuse actually can sow the seeds, so to speak, in terms of future maladaptive behavior and acting out.
Why would one child who's got insecure attachment or been physically or emotionally abused, why would one child turn into somebody who's depressed or an alcoholic and the other turn into someone who is a perpetrator?
Well, certainly that is a good question, and I don't think we have a complete answer to it. However, it turns out that obviously people are quite different from each other. Some individuals have just greater coping skills, and in psychology there's this concept called resilience, and in certain children or certain individuals are characterized by greater resilience. By that really means that they are able to cope with stress in a much better way. And this makes common sense. It's you sort of see two individuals reacting to the same situation under the same sort of stress. They don't always necessarily take the same route. One can process the sort of negative impact and the negative emotions associated with that stressful situation far better than another. Also, in certain situations when it comes to children, it depends whether there are other caregivers, whether there are other sources of attachment and sources of intimacy that the child can seek in an appropriate way, obviously, that can moderate the negative impact of somebody assaulting them or someone in the family molesting them.
Barry, you run the outpatient program there at Joseph J. Peters. I would doubt that many people knock on your door and say, I'm a perpetrator, or I'm having the impulse to have sex with my child. Please help me. How do they get to you?
That's correct, Anna. The primary way that individuals come to treatment to us is actually when they go under supervision of criminal justice system in some shape or form. So they're on probation and parole, or referred by human service departments, so some sort of identification has occurred that has forced them to seek treatment, and they're, in most cases, actually, they're mandated to receive treatment.
And tell us what treatment looks like, what the prognosis is.
Yes, the treatment actually has multiple targets. I mean, we obviously have to understand the dynamics of the particular individual. So, as I mentioned, no two people actually have this exact same pattern in terms of their histories and in terms of the motivations that characterize them. I think there would be some commonalities. But so treatment has multiple targets depending on the degree of, let's say, sexual deviance, the degree of impairment in interpersonal relationships and social skills, the degree of impairment in terms of the general psychological functioning. The treatment has to be tailored to that individual. And that really, the prerequisite of that is a thorough assessment of the individual's psychological and psychosocial characteristics and their risk level.
Tell us the prognosis. How many of these guys really do get better?
Well, surprisingly, a great number, a vast majority actually do get better. I think there's this misconception, in certain areas in public policy domains or the media that sex offenders don't respond to treatment or that they have show a high rate of recidivism. Neither of those are true.
Well, I think we need to learn much more about that, and maybe that's a topic for a whole show in itself.
Absolutely, I would think so.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time. Barry, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Sure. Christine, in the minute we have left or so, you've been in this field for a long time.
Yes.
30 years. As a matter of fact, you and I met about 15 years ago.
Oh.
And you were down in Washington. Mm-hmm. You've been on the forefront of this. What kind of impact has it had on your life?
Oh, it's had a dramatic impact on my life in terms of really having to come to grips with the cruelty that family members can perpetrate on one another, and really realizing that, and, you know, being, and I feel privileged to be able to listen to that and help people to understand that, but it's had a profound impact in that way, and it's helped me to, just like you heard from the survivors, it's helped me to be in community, it's helped me to rely on my own interpersonal networks and communities, and to really be profoundly grateful for trustworthiness, and to be very aware of dynamics of betrayal.
And you've learned a bit about secondary PTSD.
Yes, I have. Yeah. And I've been burned out periodically, but the field has been so vibrant, and there's so much being learned about interpersonal violence and traumatization that it's always been something that's pulled me back. And I feel a very strong passion for working with individuals, especially incest survivors, who have not had a voice and who have not had, professionals who really have appreciated what has happened to them.
In your years in this field, just like mine, you have seen some horrible things about humanity, and you've mm-hmm. seen the best of humanity too.
Yes, absolutely.
I want to thank you so much for joining us, Christine.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
My guest has been Dr. Christine Courtois. She is a psychologist in private practice. She's the director of Christine Courtois and Associates. She's a co-founder of the Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorders program, which still operates at the Psychiatric Institute of Washington. She's written many books, including Healing the Incest Wound, Adult Survivors in Therapy. Earlier on, we heard from Leona and Jeffrey, who were incest survivors and courageous enough to join us on the show. We also heard from criminal and civil attorney Danny Savalas, and most recently, we heard from Dr. Barry Zachary, a psychologist, director of the outpatient program at the Joseph J. Peters Institute in Philadelphia. Well, if you've got a question or comment, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Mr. Fred Snyder. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. If you want more information about incest, you can find it on our webpage. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Elisa Walters and Geeta Simons. Happy anniversary, Geeta. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.